A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for joining us on this week's edition of Utah Weekly Forum. Today, we're going to talk about Utah history, statehood, with someone that understands that more than most people here in the state of Utah. Jedediah Rogers is the co-editor of Utah Historical Quarterly, and he's a senior state historian with Utah's Division of State History. Jedediah, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I learned about something called Thrive 125 that celebrates and commemorates Utah's history of statehood. Tell me more about Thrive 125.
Well, January 4th, 2021 marks the anniversary when Utah became a state. So Thrive 125 really is an attempt to think about what statehood means, what it means to us as a people, who we are, where we've come from, what the diversity of our communities are. So it's made up of a number of different types of events and products that we want the public to be aware of.
I love that idea, though. That's such an action word, thriving, right? That 125 years later, after achieving statehood, Utah is thriving.
Yeah, you know, thriving really is, it's aspirational. We want stories to be told, to highlight various groups, to celebrate our best selves, to consider how we want to spend the next 125 years. So thriving reflects both a celebration of statehood as well as a commemoration, talking about the hard issues of where we have been in the past and where we're going in the present, because past is prologue, and where we want to go, we have to understand what the past has done and what problems, what wrongs we may have committed so we can move forward as a society.
I really love that term, the past is prologue, because those of us who love to read, or you pick up a book, and the prologue is that kind of, here's the setup of the story I'm now going to tell you. And it leads in to the future of the story. So that is a beautiful thing for us to understand, that what we are doing in the past by looking at it, that past really does influence the future of who we are and the decisions we make. I love that example. Why do you, as a historian, think it's important for us to stop down, not just honor January 4th, but to take a look at Utah's statehood and its history?
Well, statehood was clearly a seminal event in our history. And it's cast a long shadow in terms of establishing a system of governance and laws that continue to direct our lives. So I guess, I'd say that statehood marks a political transition from territory to state, but it also reflects these major economic and social transformations that were occurring in Utah at the end of the 19th century. I'd also say that the anniversary really allows us time to reflect deeply about, again, who we are as a people, as a society, as a community. The governor's office refers to the anniversary as a celebration in the sense that it provides an opportunity to celebrate who we are as a people and to highlight our arts, our literary communities. Commemoration, as I mentioned, is a really good way to think about it as well. My colleague who's up at USU, the historian Rebecca Anderson, has referred to authentic commemoration, which refers to thinking about the relationship between what we know about the past and our duties to the present moment. So this moment in time allows us to authentically commemorate by thinking about whether the values carried forward from statehood remain values to cultivate and care about today.
And we achieved statehood, was it 1896?
It was 1896.
Okay.
Yes.
So that was 125 years ago. And coming up in just a few minutes down the road in this interview, we're going to talk about some of the events that are scheduled for Thrive 125, because there are still things that we can all participate in for 2021 as part of this celebration. But take us back in history to the path to statehood. So we know we arrived in the 1840s, right? And then it took a bit. Tell us about that path. Was it difficult for us to go from being in a territory to a state?
It was as difficult as it possibly could be. It took 50 years since the first statehood petition was drafted in 1849. And it's important to recognize that, you know, when the Latter-day Saints or Mormon pioneers arrived in the Salt Lake Valley in 1847, they were not entering into unpeopled territory. This was the indigenous homelands of First Nations, of a number of tribal communities and groups, thousands of individuals. And so where they settled actually had a direct impact, and that's the story of Utah history in the 19th and even into the 20th century is conflict in many ways between, you know, settlement and the peoples who were here previously. But the first official statehood petition was started in 1849. And the first three from 1849 into the 1860s were drafted entirely by Latter-day Saints, by the Mormons, and under the direction of Brigham Young, they sought political independence. So territorial status really kept them under the thumb of the federal government, and it was just a continual bone of contention for 50 years.
And, you know, and I made a mistake too, Jedediah, in that I said we arrived in the 1840s, when the truth is, as you clarified, this land, you know, we had those who were from Mexico. We had native, tribes that lived here in this land before the pioneers arrived. Mm-hmm. So Utah's history does absolutely include their experience as well. So you had Brigham Young guiding that journey towards statehood with independence in mind, with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints values and priorities at the top of that. So was Congress putting any barriers in place that impeded that ability for Utah to obtain statehood?
They absolutely did. When it came to dealing with the Mormons, it was a big national conversation, really. Many of your listeners may recall from their U.S. history classes that the first platform of the Republican Party in 1856 called for the eradication of what was known as the twin relics of barbarism, which included slavery, which obviously as a nation we tackled, started to address with the Civil War, and then polygamy. And the principal reason why Utahns had to wait so long for statehood was this issue of polygamy, the unique marriage practices among the Latter-day Saints. So the barriers to that that the national government put in the way were several. You know, they split off chunks of the territorial borders. They whittled down the boundaries of Utah territory several times. And one bill in the 1860s proposed cutting Utah into three parts to be distributed to other states. So getting rid of Utah territory altogether. That never happened, but it was on the table. And then, of course, national legislation that was passed to punish the LDS Church, but also to curtail the practice of plural marriage. So the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act of 1862 made bigamy against the law in territories, and it wasn't a law that was really enforced. But later laws in 1882, 1887, put the hammer down hard on the practice of polygamy.
I was thinking about that there is sometimes a feeling of antagonism towards the federal government that exists in the history of Utah. And so if I go back and I think about what you shared with the Republican platform saying, let's eradicate the Mormons, right? And then the other conflicts that occurred in the future years, it makes sense that there is a sense of distrust towards the federal government. I don't want to editorialize, but that was interesting for me.
Yeah, and it was the eradication of polygamy specifically, but Mormons always felt like they were under attack, and rightfully so. You know, I mean, James Buchanan in 18 57 sent an army to quell a supposed rebellion in the territory. And actually, at that time, he replaced Brigham Young as territorial governor. So there were always this tension in the air in territorial Utah between religious authority and national politics in the American mainstream. One major concern that Americans had was over Mormon political power in the territory. So in addition to polygamy, it's their political control. And what we see in the years between the first statehood petition in 1849 and the subsequent statehood attempts was this concerted effort among national politicians to largely curtail Mormon control over political affairs in the territory, not just to eradicate polygamy, but to minimize their impact in the political affairs of the territory.
So that, again, there's more that conflict, right, in fiction between the goals of Brigham Young and those living here. And it was a growing population. During those years, weren't we seeing also that through immigration, that this territory was becoming more and more populated and therein more and more of a political threat to those who felt threatened by the influence of the Mormons politically?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we oftentimes think of territorial Utah as being the Mormon pioneer story, and that's a narrative that has been dominant through the 20th century and into the 21st. But we need to really correct it in the sense that, again, we mentioned the First Peoples who have always been here in the state. But, you know, especially after the construction of the railroad in 1869, Utah saw just an influx of people flooding into the territory. And as a result, the political winds really were shifting. And this lends itself by the 1890s to allow Congress to actually see fit to designate Utah as a state. You know, whereas in 1870, over 95% of the state was LDS. By 1890, a full third of the state was composed of folks other than Mormons, you know, merchants, miners, rail workers, people from all types of denominations. So Utah's population was becoming more and more diverse. And in places by the 1880s and 1890s, cities like Ogden and Salt Lake City, the Latter-day Saints had lost their political foothold on city governance, or they had to share city governance with folks who were not of the Mormon faith. So that helped to break the statehood logjam.
That's really interesting to think back in 1890, already there was one-third of the population of the territory that were not directly a part of the Mormon pioneer.
Right, and yeah, you know, that third would increase into 1920 when it was a full 40%, the highest that it's been, you know, 40% of individuals are not of the Mormon faith, and that's significant. That just reflects the kind of multicultural and international demographic that Utah has.
By 1920, 40%. So we start seeing more and more diverse ideas and thoughts influencing the politics. Tell me about the Constitutional Convention. What was happening in the mid-1890s that led up to that final decision granting Utah a statehood?
Well, there were a couple of things that allowed statehood to happen. One was, I have to mention, the manifesto that was a declaration issued by the LDS Church president, Wilford Woodruff, that basically the Mormons, the official church, LDS Church, was willing to capitulate on the issue of plural marriage. So this signaled a softening of conflict, I guess, over the question of plural marriage. And this, in addition to Utahns working behind the scenes to generate support from national political leaders like James Blaine, who was Secretary of State, or commercial folks like the railroad baron Leland Stanford and others. Anyway, all of this helped to lead to a swing in the tide of public opinion by the early 1890s. I should also mention that a challenge to statehood, which was political organization in the territory along religious lines, that also began to change in the early 1890s. So for the first time in 1891, the national political parties appeared on the ballot box. And the earlier parties, which were organized around a religious affiliation, the People's Party and the Liberal Party, those had been disbanded. So by the time, by 1894, Congress then enacts the Enabling Act, which gave Utahns essentially the green light to organize a convention to draft a constitution.
That's so interesting to me. For those who have just joined us, by the way, this is Jedediah Rogers. He's a co-editor of Utah Historical Quarterly, a journal that reflects the history of Utah. He's also a senior state historian with Utah's Division of State History. What benefits would the people of Utah experience having statehood versus still living in a territory?
Well, it allowed Utahns to have more representation in Congress. Now there were two senators and also a member of the House of Representatives that had votes in U.S. Congress. It allowed Utahns to choose their own political officials and enabled them to be more stitched together tightly with the American political system and the American mainstream. I mean, once Utahns seen as outsiders, they were increasingly welcomed as loyal Americans. But again, it's so statehood was greeted with quite a bit of celebration. There were parades and you know, celebrations on the streets in the towns in the state. But, you know, we need to recognize that statehood, it was a political designation, and its boundaries of statehood were imposed on, over, and through the homelands of indigenous peoples. So while it did grant us people here in Utah a number of benefits, I guess you could say, it also signaled the final removal of indigenous peoples, Native Americans, from their homelands. And I'd say that for some, statehood marks a loss, whereas for it also signals a gain, certainly. But the place that we call Utah was built on Native American spaces, oftentimes without consent. So it's important to recognize that as we're talking about statehood.
So as it's celebrated by one part of the population of the state of Utah, it was also representative of a great loss to those who this was their original homeland.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I'm not an indigenous person, but I really feel like statehood, it has a bunch of conflicting meanings and legacies, and that's one of them. You know, this final loss of a homeland that had been theirs for generations. So we need to be sensitive to that, and also find ways to move forward that recognizes those realities.
We've been talking about Utah's history, its history to statehood, because we are celebrating 125 years or marking 125 years that Utah has had its history with its statehood designation with an event called Thrive 125. Jedediah, on January 4th, there was a broadcast. What was its goal, the Thrive 125 January 4th broadcast?
Well, The broadcast was created, as is all of the Thrive 125 events, by the Department of Heritage and Arts, which is a department here in the state of Utah, and also by the governor's office. They designed the broadcast. I watched it on January 4th. It was terrific, very inspiring. But it highlights, again, who we are as a people, where we came from, the diversity of our communities, by showcasing our talented performance and literary artists around the state, frankly, at a time when individuals working in the arts and cultural communities have been hard hit with the pandemic. So the broadcast served to employ some of them, but I think more importantly, it highlighted the richness of our arts and culture in the state. And it was truly, you know, watching it, does feel like a celebration that we're part of something bigger and larger than ourselves.
And I'm glad that you mentioned that those who are performing, the performing arts have definitely hit a tremendous obstacle with the pandemic that limited crowd sizes and shut down performance halls. It's been a very difficult time for them. So the Thrive 125 broadcast to see them all performing was really quite beautiful. There are other events. We have about 5 minutes left in our Utah Weekly Forum. There are other Thrive 125 events going on this year. Can you share some of those with us?
Yeah, again, the Department of Heritage and Arts, in collaboration with Utah Humanities, organized these events to provide interesting discussions on various aspects of our history. Many of them highlight our landscape and natural environment. Some address more difficult aspects of Utah history and statehood. So there were a number of events that have been featured and that are still available on the Thrive 125 website for viewing, but these include a play called Suffrage, which is a story about two plural wives in the 1880s living in a household that was then under siege by the federal government over the practice of plural marriage. There's been an event on when Utah was Mexican territory, which focuses on, you know, that history prior to 1847 and what it means to Utah today, featuring Armando Solorzano and Sherman Fleek. There was another one on stories of refugees, stories of people who find sanctuary in Utah. Another one, a conversation with Native American storytellers. One that I was able to listen to was about Utah's most famous land art, the Spiral Jetty on the Great Salt Lake, which is kind of an enlightening conversation about what that art piece means and then what the landscape and its significance is to our state. There'll be another one on highlighting the history of women in science and technology. And then on March 3rd, there's actually an event that I'm involved with that features historians reflecting on the meanings of statehood. Why do we remember statehood? How has it shaped us as a people, and so on. So our events, I mean, these events have been successful. Many of them have had hundreds of people zooming in, hundreds more watching the event later via YouTube. And you can access the YouTube channel from thrive125.utah.gov. I spoke with Willie Palomo of Utah Humanities, who organized these events. He said that for him, a takeaway was that Utah is clearly ready and hungry for thoughtful and honest conversations about our past, especially when it comes to learning more about stories of historically marginalized peoples.
And we'll have a chance to do that, to elevate. That's one of the beautiful things about the arts, and whether it's literature, right, or whether it is performance art, or whether it's storytelling or visual art, is that it gives voice to people's experiences. And how beautiful that is, that there's an ongoing series, Thrive 125, for us to hear those voices and to learn more of their stories and become more inclusive of a state as we move forward into the future. Jedediah Rogers, the co-editor of Utah Historical Quarterly and a senior state historian with the Utah Division of State History. What date is your event you mentioned that you're a part of?
Yeah, it's on March 3rd at 7 p.m. And again, you can register for the event at thrive125.utah.gov.
Great. And we can get a big picture of all the events at that same website, thrive125.utah.gov. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking time to help us set the foundation of why we are commemorating 125 years of state history and how it can influence our future together. Thank you for joining us on this week's edition of Utah Weekly Forum.
Thank you so much.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on kslpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.